All right, welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Matt Taibbi.
And I'm Katie Halper.
And this is the speed I want to do the entire show at.
Which is what speed?
Like the faster
speed. Oh, yeah, let's do it.
Upbeat.
All right, upbeat. Yeah, let's do it.
Pace. Lots of stuff to go through this week. We have a really fascinating guest. Actually, literally
we
one of the most...
you not.
You will find out why that pun is appropriate. But one of the most interesting people I've ever interviewed.
Which
I shit you not.
Yeah, you've interviewed a lot of people, so.
So that's, but we'll keep it a secret. Quickly, we have to get, because since it's not part of the program that we have scheduled, we should probably just sort of mention that, you know, the latest development in the Assange case, since like only eight people are going to talk about it otherwise.
It's really ridiculous.
So there was a Yahoo News did an investigation. Like Yahoo News, randomly.
I know.
Like, what's that all about? And I guess the angle for people is that this came from the Trump administration, which makes sense in that sense. But, you know, essentially there was a plan. Well, it was discussed within the CIA that they might deem WikiLeaks a quote non-state hostile intelligence service, which could lead to kidnapping and even assassinating Julian Assange. Of course, they didn't follow through on it. They just talked about it, right? Like, you know,
yeah.
Like, that's a crime. I mean, really, you know.
Come on, are we not allowed to discuss possibilities? It's a free country.
Exactly. You know, it's funny. Eons ago, I believe it or not, was at a baseball game with a justice official.
Wow.
Yeah, it's kind of random. It was somebody who was a source on something else. And the subject of Assange very briefly came up. And this was in the Obama years. He sort of just casually described him as, well, you know, it's a hostile terrorist organization. So I think this is like the prevailing thinking, you know,
right.
You know what I'm saying? Like this, I don't think this was a
unique to Trump.
Unique to Trump or unique even to a few people. I think this is kind of the prevailing view. You know, we've had hints of this from Hillary Clinton saying, why can't we just drone him, right? Allegedly, you know, to the fact that they did 1,000 different insane things to him while he was in custody and
looked through his kids' diapers.
Yeah, all that stuff. So,
and shout out to friend of show Max Blumenthal for reporting on this stuff earlier. I don't think with this evidence, but there is a Spanish case about this, about the treatment, about what UC Global, which is a Spanish security firm, what they were doing at the behest, we thought, of the CIA, but now we know that the CIA, I guess, really was talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before, right, they were just saying that they were doing it.
But nonetheless, life goes on. The Assange case goes on. So four food groups, Democrats suck, Republicans suck. Isn't that weird? Isn't that terrible? I know I promised not to belabor this whole issue, but I did want to... I just felt like, since nobody else was talking about this, wanted to mention a little teeny tiny part of the Sussman indictment. It's a really good Democrat suck to me, I think. So this indictment is special counsel John Durham, who was sort of charged with investigating potential crimes, basically involving fraudulently setting up Russiagate, right? And this indictment is the second one. Like, the first one involved an FBI agent who lied to get FISA authority to listen into Carter Page. So that was the first one. This second one is sort of, that just happened, is sort of the bigger one. And it's against Michael Sussman, who was one of the Hillary Clinton campaign's lawyers. And the charges for lying to the FBI. Do you remember the Alpha Capital story, that crazy story that Donald Trump was communicating by a secret server with there is a mysterious computer server that is communicating with Alpha Bank in Russia?
Vaguely. It all
blends
together, honestly. No, I don't think so. Is that's different from Deutsche Bank?
No, this is very different from Deutsche Bank.
Okay.
Maybe Matt, while I'm talking, if you could look it up, the Franklin Foyer piece. It was a big story. Here it is. Yeah. Was a Trump server communicating with Russia? And this was
a seance.
Yeah, no, it's this completely batshit story, if you read it, essentially it's a bunch of computer scientists who are all anonymous and using like sexy spy pseudonyms like Tea Leaves. And they're claiming that there is indecipherable computer chatter between a Trump-linked organization and a bank in Russia called Alpha Bank, but they couldn't tell what the communications were, but you know, they kind of suggested that they were illicit. The story was so ridiculous that the New York Times actually kind of blew it off.
Wow.
They did report that the FBI was investigating it, but they're like, nah, this doesn't look like anything. And even the Washington Post sort of did, but a lot of other people reported it. It was on MSNBC, CNN. Rachel went nuts over it. She, you know, she was saying, we're so fortunate to have journalists as talented as you looking into this. When that came on, Chris Hayes, poor guy, he fell for this. Lots of other people. Anyway, the indictment is about how they cooked up this phony story, and most of it is about how the Clinton lawyers and this other guy basically leaned on these computer executives to drum up something that they said, you know, would at least sound plausible to reporters, even though they all protested and said, this isn't going to pass the smell test. Like, nobody will believe it. And they're like, yeah, whatever. Don't worry about it. Anyway, they bring it to the FBI, which to me is, I mean, it's a crime. You're like reporting a false crime, basically, to the FBI. And everybody's already gone over this. There's been a lot of discussion in the media about this. But there's a section in the end of this indictment that nobody's really talked about, which I thought was amazing. And this is the part that I wanted to kind of go over just really quickly. And Matt, if we could, again, just look at that. This is page 23. And this is after the election. It's somewhere like around January, late January of 2017. So Trump's about to take office. It reads like this. Approximately 1 month later, Sussman contacted a former employee of Agency 2, the former employee, in a further attempt to attain a meeting at Agency 2. The former employee communicated with Sussman on or about January 31st, 2017, during which the following in substance and part occurred. So Agency 2, we think, is the CIA, by the way. He had already gone to the FBI. Now they wanted to go and try to sell this phony story to a different agency.
Okay.
Contrary to his prior false representation to the FBI general counsel and a representation that he would subsequently make to Agency 2, see below, Sussman advised the former employee that he represented a, quote, client. B, Sussman summarized the updated allegations, which is just like the same story about the secret communication between Trump and Alpha Bank. And then C, Sussman requested that the former employee assist him in obtaining a meeting with Agency 2 and stated that if Agency 2 was not interested, Sussman's client would likely to go to Newspaper 1, which is the New York Times, by the way, with the allegations. This is a lawyer for the Democratic Party for the Hillary Clinton campaign, going to the CIA, pretty sure, saying and going to a former CIA official at this point, saying, if you can't get me a meeting at the actual CIA about this Alpha Bank business, we're going to go to the New York Times and tell them that you refuse to take a meeting about Trump's collusion with this Russian bank. It's not exactly blackmail, but it's pretty close. And this tells you a lot about how a lot of these stories came to be. So they did it both ways, right? So that, you know, in some cases they would go and get the FBI or some agency interested in some of these things. And then they would go to a newspaper and say, look, the FBI is interested. Therefore, right, you should write a story. But then they also went the other way where they would say, okay, well, if you don't do an investigation into this matter that we want publicized, then we're going to tell the newspapers that you're refusing to investigate Trump's collusion.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes. So is there a term for this? You should come up with a term for this.
I mean, it's blackmail, but it's not the legal definition of it, right? It's they're essentially leveraging their connections with a newspaper.
Right. And they're leveraging their connection to the newspaper and also like threatening to tar these people as Trump enablers.
as Trump enablers and potentially colluders with Russia.
Right.
This is like peering, you know, behind the looking glass at how, remember, at the time we were kind of, a lot of us were watching these stories come over the wire and saying, wow, it's amazing. They've got all this stuff. Like there has to be something there, right? Because, you know, where are all these headlines coming from? And then we start, you know, through stuff like this, we start to find out where some of these stories came from. It's just like it's a glimpse into how this particular sausage got made. I thought this was classic because it's the Clinton campaign. They're going to get away with this. Like
yeah.
they've gotten away with it already, unless there are many more indictments to come. And, you know, some of these defendants start talking and saying terrible things. It's a window into, you know, what Russiagate was on some level.
A very scrupulous investigation.
Well, right, yeah, I mean, it's so absurd. You know, they hire this big fancy law firm, a well-known cybersecurity lawyer, Sussman's a former justice official, right? He's not a nobody. He's like one of, you know, an expensive Washington lawyer. You know, they essentially cook up. He goes to some friends and has them lean on some university computer experts to drum up a story. And there's a really funny part in the indictment where this other tech executive tells these computer experts, if you spend more than an hour trying to make this make sense, you failed the assignment. So in other words, he's saying like, don't work too hard at it.
Right.
So they come up with this really stupid story that none of them think is going to pass the smell test. They take it to the FBI because they have because this guy's a former justice official and he has connections there. And they use that to go to the New York Times and say, well, the FBI is investigating it. You should look at it. And, you know, that's how stuff gets into the newspaper. Like it, that, you know, people think that everything that they see in the news doesn't have a backstory to it, but, you know, very, very often it does have, there is a whole process to getting things in the news. And this is just a good example of how it happens.
Yeah, the story, like there's a story behind the story.
Right, right.
It's newsworthy, but that no one will cover. And that people will just call you a Russian apologist. And you in particular, both the collective you and also you, the Matt Taibbi.
Yeah, yeah. I would say that this is not the end of the story, though, because from everything I hear, there's at least a couple more shoes that have to drop. Although, can a couple more shoes drop? Does it only have to be one more shoe?
I mean, I feel like now that we're mentioning it, it's kind of an ableist expression based on having 2 feet.
Well, could you have 3 feet?
I think you could, right?
Yeah.
I mean, or you could have 1 foot and then there's just no other option for another shoe. So then what do you do?
There's another theoretical
We have to have a name for this one where we problematize terminology.
Yeah. Yeah. We need to.
Oh, we need the woke button.
We need to wokeify cliches is what it is.
Oh, right. Yeah. We need a woke cliche button.
We need
to wokeify cliches. Yeah. So that waiting for the other shoe to drop could be, God, can we even go there at all?
I don't know. Waiting for the other article of clothing.
Yeah. But of course, then what about people who don't wear clothing? Yeah. I guess all people, even in remote areas, they wear something, right? But then it's like they don't have as many. If they just wear like a loincloth, they don't even have that option. Well, maybe there's some jewelry involved. But so what do you predict is happening? What's the other garment of whatever that could drop?
Well, I just think that there's probably some more indictments coming. There's going to be a report coming. Question of how much of that gets made public by Merrick Garland. It's kind of a reverse Mueller. It's sort of interesting. So
reverse Mueller, that sounds like a sports thing.
Yeah. What would a reverse Mueller in gymnastics look like?
Do we even want to know?
I'm not sure we want to know. Anyway, while we consider that, what do we have for Republican suck?
Okay. So for Republican suck, just reading an important article, Trump called press secretary from Air Force One to defend shape and size of his penis, new book claims. So Donald Trump was on board Air Force One when he felt compelled to deny claims from adult film film star Stormy Daniels that his appendage was shaped like the mushroom character from Mario Kart. According to new reports, the former president called the press secretary Stephanie Grisham to assure her that his penis was in fact neither small nor bore a resemblance to a cartoon fungus. I think it's kind of an unnecessary thing, bringing in the fungus. But apparently, and this, by the way, this claim was made by Ms. Grisham in an upcoming book called I'll Take Your Questions Now, What I Saw in the White House, preview copies of which were delivered to the Washington Post and New York Times ahead of its release on October 5th. We should read some of that. So I guess he said he called her. And she says that she said to that, yes, sir. Guess what? Mr. Trump obviously is denying it. Trump is saying that it's untrue. And he, of course, is smearing Grisham. He's saying that she doesn't have what it takes, didn't have what it takes after a breakup, in an apparent reference to her split with another White House official, Max Miller. And then Trump says she became very angry and bitter after a breakup. And as time went on, she was seldom relied on or even thought about. She had big problems. And we felt that she should work out those problems for herself. Now, like everyone else, she gets paid by a radical left-leaning publisher to say bad and untrue things. Let's see. Then Trump's spokeswoman, Liz Harrington, pushed back also and said publishers should be ashamed of themselves for preying on desperate people who see the short-term game in writing a book full of falsehoods. The little substance of her book has, if you can make it through the juvenile gossip, flies in the face of reality and deserves no serious recognition. So what happened was that Ms. Stormy Daniels said in her own memoir, Full Disclosure, she said that Trump had a smaller than average, but not freakishly small penis, and that it was unusually shaped. And in the book, she says, I lay there annoyed that I was getting F'd by a guy with Yeti pubes and a dick like the mushroom character in Mario Kart. He knows he has an unusual penis. It has a huge mushroom head, like a toadstool. Then she later regretted thrusting Mr. Trump's genitals into the public's consciousness, saying it amounted to body shaming. Mm. Yeah, I guess he, that's the story. We really should get our hands on that book and read about it.
Oh, on the book, okay.
Yeah, on the book, yeah. I mean, mushroom-shaped toadstool? Is that body shaming? I get what's Yeti pubes?
Yeti
what are
pubes.
Yeti? What are Yeti pubes?
Yeti, the abominable snowman. Like, sorry, really hairy.
Right. Yeti is, yeah. What's his name? We don't know if he exists.
It's like Himalaya Sasquatch.
Yeah, Sasquatch. That's, yeah. Is that the same creature or just another possible?
It's the same one, but he's a snow version.
It's like the same creature in snow, or they're totally different but equivalent to each other. I realize I don't know a lot of. Okay, so that's Yeti.
Yeah, no, the Yeti is a what I think a Nepalese or Himalayan legend.
Okay.
Right.
And
Sasquatch is the Pacific Northwest. He's brown. You know, he was in Harry and the Hendersons.
Right. So that's also problematic. That's not a cliche, but it's a problematic. It's somehow problematic. The Yeti.
Forget
the body shaming. It's just cultural appropriation.
Oh, it's cultural appropriation. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
So Stormy Daniels owes two apologies now.
Wilson, can we see Mario Kart?
Oh, wow. So for people who are just watching, how would you describe that? It's a very heavy on the bulge toadstool. Oh, my God. That is so cute. What is that? That's Mario Kart? Who is that? I know nothing about this stuff.
That's you Toad really from Mario.
Okay, that's Toad from Mario. So that's what. Okay, but there in this picture, he looks kind of like Aladdin. So what's the difference between Toad from Mario standing up and problematic, but Aladdin, we got an elongated full, I wouldn't say fully bodied because he's basically has no legs, but a big torso, little arms and feet, and like an Aladdin style vest. So okay, that either way they're both really cute as creatures, not as penises.
Look, I think it's fair to say that strategically, If a porn star says that you have a small penis that looks like a character in Mario Kart, you probably shouldn't call a female aid and complain about it, because that will end up in a book.
Right.
And that will lend credence to the story.
Yes. He just, right. Like, why do you have to assure anyone that your penis is not in fact shaped like a toadstool or small.
Right.
You should be secure enough in your penis size and shape.
Right. Remember in the debate when he said, like, there's no problem there, believe me.
Yeah, that was because he called
Marco Rubio.
Sorry, Marco Rubio. Mario Kart, Marco Rubio. Yeah, little Marco. And then Marco referred to his hand size. And then he said, Marco Rubio said, I'll admit he's taller than me. He's like 6'2", which is why I don't understand why his hands are the size of someone who is 5'2". Have you seen his hands? And you know what they say about men with small hands? You can't trust them. So then Trump pushed back. Nobody has ever hit my hands. I've never heard of this. But do you know this? You know that someone did refer to his hands.
What's the name? Graydon Carter thing?
Yeah. Graydon Carter.
Oh, of course. Yeah, I read that was from Spy Magazine, which I read religiously throughout the 90s. Yeah.
So what did he say? He called him a
short-fingered vulgarian. Every time they referred to Donald Trump in the magazine, it would say short-fingered vulgarian Donald Trump.
Right. Yes, short thing of Bulgarian, right? So,
and it drove Trump nuts.
Crazy, right? So guys, we just caught Trump in a lie because he said no one's ever hit me on my hands, and we know that is an outright lie.
Well, I mean, hands and fingers are two different things.
Oh, come on, fingers count. Fingers are part of hands.
I guess you can have small hands and long fingers.
You are a Trump defender.
I am. Yeah, I'm totally in the bag for Trump.
Wait, you could have long hands. Wait, you could have, you're right. He could have big hands, short fingers, which is like even worse.
Yeah.
I don't know which is worse, small hands, all small proportionate hands?
I mean, I think you want them to be proportional no matter what. I think that's kind of the first consideration.
Oh, wait a second though. If they were short, would that be consistent with the penis allegation? In other words, if he had short fingers, big hands, no, then the penis version of that would not be small. Which is what he has, apparently. He has small with abnormally large head. Is that what Daniel is saying?
Yeah.
I thought you'd be into this penis math.
Look, it's hilarious.
Right. I'm just trying to figure out what the equivalent would be.
I mean, I think on the list of things that bother Donald Trump, it's probably in the top 8.
Right.
You know?
I'm just saying the penis equivalent of what Carter is accusing him of having. What's a short-fingered vulgarian penis version of that? What is the penile short-fingered vulgarian?
Yeah, I don't know. A micro penis. I don't know. It's like the.
I don't know, maybe it lines up because she's saying it's small, not that small. Which, if we think he has normal-sized hands with short fingers, anyway, that's. I don't know if that's a good Republican suck. That's almost the Republicans are awesome.
No, that.
It's
Republicans don't know how to handle themselves.
Yeah, handle.
Probably don't sleep with a porn star and have it end poorly. Like, I think that's...
Yeah. Not that there's anything wrong with that, just the optics when you're especially... I was going to say especially when you're Republican, but actually either one, this country isn't really ready for that. But you're saying... You're just saying for the disc potential.
Yeah, for the disc potential. Yeah, exactly.
I'm actually really surprised he never hit back about her. You know, he wanted to. There must have been so much coaching for him not to.
I don't even want to think about what I can already imagine the things that he would say. But
do you watch Curb Your Enthusiasm? I forget.
I do. Yeah.
Remember the one where this woman accuses Jeff of having a small penis and Jeff responds by saying actually she has a huge vagina. Yeah.
I don't know that that would really be an insult in this case.
It would look defensive.
Like, he just played this one poorly. Like, it you know.
Right.
That's a 9-putt to me. We've left out the major thing, which is that if he wanted to disprove the theory, he could just whip it out.
You're right. I'm actually surprised he didn't do that. Kind of like the character in Waiting for Guffman, Ron and Sheila, the travel agents, when he reveals at dinner in a Chinese restaurant that he had to have penis reduction surgery.
Right, yeah.
That's such a great scene.
That was a good one, though. I like that. Isn't that weird? We got a good one. Can we start, Matt, with Macron's egging? There, see?
Yeah. This is the one where French President Emmanuel Macron was hit with an egg in Lyon, France.
Look, I think this is weak, and I'm gonna make a case. I'm going to make a video case for why this is weak. First of all, the egg didn't even break.
I know. Right? Was that a hard-boiled egg? It looked like a hard-boiled egg.
Yeah, and so first of all, throwing an egg at a politician is weak to begin with because it's not original. It's been done before, right, and there's a whole history of it.
Politicians being hit by eggs. This is a video compilation. Australian PM Scott Morrison narrowly avoided a close range egging. You can barely see that.
See? That's weak.
Yeah, where did it go? Is it behind his head?
It just bounced off his head.
You're the politicians who weren't so lucky.
Right. I don't know who that guy is, actually. But look, that one cracked.
Yeah, when you crack, that's good.
Right? But, it's got to at least crack. Ooh, that one's
that's good.
A good
one too.
No, wait. Can we stop?
That's a little kid.
This one is great because the kid has the balls to physically crack it and stand there.
Yes.
And film the reaction shot. Yeah. If we could see that whole sequence, a lot of equanimity in this kid.
Seriously, is, a lot of
valor. He's ready for the business. Let's see how that work goes again. See, look. Really
wow.
good.
Wow, and that
right?
one just pops. Yeah, he turns around. Yeah. He doesn't go anywhere.
All right. A crucial time. He's trying to vote. Yeah. Hit him with an egg.
Another one, yeah.
Right.
Who made this video, though? Very
responsive. That looks Slavic.
Oh, here's David Cameron. Let's see what happens here. Whoa. Can't even see. That was a
wasted. You can't even see it. That's wasted. You gotta get a good camera angle.
Oh,
that's good one.
I like that.
He fights back.
Look at that. Tubby gentleman. Oh, that does not end well because he's on the floor.
Oh!
That's different. That's like, all right, four people. People who are just watching.
Not one of my
listening.
Fans.
Not one of my fans.
So that's different. That's a sneak attack. That's, in that case, the guy cracks an egg. Wait, what was that? Hold on. That one. Oh, that's that scary Austrian guy. No, it's scary. Niles, whatever, the Brit. Scary Brit guy.
And we have another one with him. Here's John Major.
John Major. Deep cut.
Yeah, all right. Well, we have enough eggings here.
Enough eggings. Some are good. People should rate them.
I think the only thing we can conclude from the eggings is, one, you have to crack it. You have to physically make sure that it cracks.
Yeah.
Preferably by actually pressing it against the politician's head. Right? That's one. Two is the only proper response for a politician is to actually just turn around and deck the person who does it.
Yeah. I don't know. Not if you're, it depends how you wind up. You know what I mean? What if you deck them, but then you wind up being punched out? At least you still made the effort. Maybe the real response is just pretend it didn't happen.
Yeah, I guess you can either pretend it didn't happen. I think instantaneously decking the person is probably a safe call on almost every instance, but you're right. Pretending it didn't happen probably works.
But I do want to raise one question, which is there is one move where we saw someone almost fake, like pat the guy on the shoulder and there was an egg there. And that's a cowardly move.
Yeah, because it's like you're pretending to be his buddy, but it turns out to be like you're leaving an egg on him. Like you should just grind it into his head, right? Like menacingly. Yeah. Here's some other famous incidences of things being thrown at politicians. And famous people, obviously, I think the shoe at George Bush was an important moment.
That guy's a hero.
Okay, all right.
So what if the guy threw a shoe at me?
First of all, that's like extra props because how you ever get past all the security, right? I mean, I guess you got to wear shoes, right?
So, that's it. That's a brilliant thing. Talking about waiting for the other shoe to drop. Wow. Coming full circle.
Right. And that's creative. Like who's ever thrown a shoe at a politician? Who's thrown two shoes at a politician?
Yeah, you're right. Wow,
right?
Coming full circle again, waiting for the other shoe to drop. He was waiting, Bush. I think everyone was surprised by his wits. The only problem with that is that it almost made Bush look...
It did almost make Bush look good. Yeah, actually. Bush kind of handled that well.
I wouldn't have been able to duck, I don't think. Maybe it's... Do you think it's just an instinct?
it is kind of an instinct. I mean, it depends on how you want to play it. Like, you know, the Clint Eastwood school would just be to let the shoe bounce off your head and harmlessly, right. Like, it, you know, it didn't affect you at all, you know, but going like that, like you're scared. I don't know. I think he came out looking all right in that one.
Do you know who did it and what he said?
I don't remember.
It was in 2008. And it was an Iraqi journalist, Muntadhar Al-Zaidi. And it was during an Iraqi press conference. And what he yelled at him was, "This is a farewell kiss from the Iraqi people, dog."
Well, good. Yeah, no, I think he got his point across. Here's somebody who didn't handle it well.
I don't like that he called him a dog, but besides that.
It's offensive to dogs. Here's a colleague of ours, Thomas Friedman at Brown University. This is a fun one.
Thank you, Oswaldo. Thank you for that kind introduction. And it's great to be back here at Brown. I haven't been here for about 6 or 7 years.
What was that?
It's pie.
So you got two people. For people just listening, you got two young men, it looks like, coming up to Friedman, who's wearing all black, which makes it all the more dramatic.
Well, because that's kind of his look. Remember, he used to wear that on like Charlie Rose.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure he wore that for his famous.
Oh, it was on Earth Day. That's why it's green.
I gotta say this critically as someone who's pied somebody in the past. If you're gonna pie somebody, you gotta hit them. You can't
hit him in the face.
You can't just stop 5 feet away or even 10 feet away like that other guy and just kind of throw the pie. You gotta like run up to the dude and like pie him.
But you laughed, even though they failed. You laughed, so it kind of.
I mean, I laughed because he was clearly rattled by the whole thing, and Also, it's just funny. Like, I don't know how much did he get paid for that speech at Brown? Like, probably, you know, $90,000 or some ridiculous thing like that, right? So it worked out to be like somehow the karma worked out.
Matt, you don't want to share with people who you pied?
I made a pie, a cream pie out of horse sperm once, and put it in the face of the Moscow, the bureau chief of the New York Times.
And how did that what happened after that?
So he thought it was a cream pie, so he kind of like.
No, he didn't.
Like licked it, yeah.
It was a cream pie, but it was a horse cream pie.
Right,
some young horse.
Cream of some young horse. We actually went to a horse farm and paid them to jerk off a horse for that.
No,
stunt.
You didn't.
Well,
that's good. That's respecting the horse's time.
Well. Yeah, I actually wasn't there for that part of it, but we got photos. So,
oh my God.
Yeah, it was.
And why did you do this? Like, why was he the victim?
He had won. We had like this worst journalist in Moscow competition, and he was our winner. So that was like the prize. Anyway, moving on. An even better thing to do to a politician. Could we see Vitaly Jurovsky?
He is a deputy and in parliament, as you say, a part of a party that
Ukrainian.
Is pro-Russian. But in particular, the emotions are running high because parliament was set to vote on a vetting law, anti-corruption.
It's
called lustration law, which people hope will be able to cleanse the government of corrupt
politicians. Okay, so
politicians,
they put, this is awful. So they put a guy in a garbage
Viktor administration.
And yeah.
A garbage, not pail. What is that? A garbage vat? What is that?
It's like a dumpster. Yeah.
A dumpster. Yeah, dumpster. Thank you.
And they had a whole bunch of them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They kept him there. Like they wouldn't let him leave. They put their hand on his head, on his forehead.
And then they put like a tire and other garbage on top of him.
And then they're rocking the dumpster.
Yeah. I'm trying to see what those signs say, but I can't read that stuff. Anyway. So
my uncle apparently put a girl he had a crush on in middle school in a garbage.
But did that work?
In a playful way. I'm not sure. She was very skinny, so he kind of just folded her up
that
in a nonviolent way.
Closer to demented than cute.
No, it was funny, apparently.
Yeah?
I should go back and find her. Yeah, make sure she's okay.
All right. I'll take your word for it. Two more quick ones. This was a whole trend, believe it or not. Could we see Nigel Farage? note that CBS, in its delivery of this story, that they really, really worked the puns and funny language in the script. So that tells you, I always appreciate that. Anyway, yeah. Go ahead.
Now to the UK, where demonstrators aren't just hurling insults at politicians, they're hurling milkshakes. Gwen Bumgardner's in London with more on how the sweet treat is being used as a tool of protest.
Okay, good stuff.
A warm welcome for British politician Nigel Farage took a cold turn at a campaign stop in England.
A cold turn.
The divisive Brexit Party leader was hit by a banana and salted caramel milkshake. He and his tailored suit became the latest target of milkshaking, a political statement making a splash in Britain.
Complete failure.
Protesters are targeting right-wing politicians on the campaign trail.
McDonald's has made the decision to stop selling milkshakes when there's a Brexit rally nearby.
This technique I like when you walk toward the camera.
Burger King UK came under fire after tweeting, "Dear people of Scotland, we're selling milkshakes all weekend. Have fun." But police aren't laughing. They arrested Farage's attacker and charged him with assault. Spilled milk or not, Farage's Brexit party is set to do well in this week's European elections. Gwen Baumgardner, CBS News, London.
I like the fact that they knew it was a banana and salted caramel milkshake, which
I know.
How tells me
know?
That somebody either tasted it or they had a source who...
They had a source.
Yeah, so that's funny. Either way, it's funny.
That is, you can't taste it and know it's banana, salted caramel. I submit that that requires a source. That's too specific.
It's too specific, yeah,
mint
exactly.
Mint chocolate, which, sure.
That's a little bit of a burn on Farage. Like, we asked the people who did this what flavor it was, and we thought that was funny enough to report. So, like,
unless there was a manifesto that the guy wrote.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. I threw this banana and salted caramel milkshake on behalf of the People's Front of whatever, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it could have been that, I guess.
Could have been that, yeah.
Just last one, I really want to quickly, because I think basically all of these things, if you compare them to this, it just doesn't measure up, so to speak. This is New Zealand Economic Minister Stephen Joyce.
Absolutely. We always take something away from every meeting we have.
Oh, oh my God. Is that what I think it is?
Yeah.
Okay, Matt, you can describe it.
It's a dildo right in the face.
Yeah. Dildo to the face. Is that the woman who did it?
Yeah.
For raping our country because of the TPPA and selling.
We have.
And what did she say? Wow.
It's kind of like the Marsha thing, you know?
Yeah.
Absolutely. We always take something away from every meeting we have. Oh, oh yes.
It matches his shirt too. He's wearing a pink shirt. Yeah.
Yeah.
That looks like a, yeah, that was well done to that woman, I guess. So, and she was protesting some environmental thing, I guess, that he was raping the country.
Right. But it landed exactly right. Like it could have landed,
right?
Well, it could have landed like head forward and it could have been unclear what it was, or could have landed.
See, right. The angle, though.
It landed like, so you got a good visual of.
It was a diagonal.
It was a diagonal shot.
Which made it very clear. Right. You're right. It would have been harder to see if it had been from the back.
And the fact that it was a lesser known minister, somehow that makes it slightly funnier.
Well, that's because it's going to overshadow. It'll over dildo him. I was going to say over dildo him, but he'll be over dildo. He'll always live in the shadow of the dildo.
Right.
Right. Because like if he were better known, then it's competing with other things about him.
Yeah, exactly. Like this, he's going to be linked to that dildo for the rest of his life. That sound, like, could we just hear sound?
Yeah, it's pretty great sound. Oh my God, look at the freeze. Oh my God, that's amazing. And also we should describe to people, it's a peachy flesh color with kind of a straw with the
plum color
pink, with a plumish mauvish pink tip, you know, if Mario what is it, if you will,
Mario Kart,
what's his name, Matt
Mario
Wilson?
Kart,
no, it's toad, yeah, head toad head. That's a great image that Matt Wilson just froze that on. Could
is that before
be
or after?
Oh, good question. I don't know. Let's play it. Let's see. I say after. It was right before, right? I don't know. We got to play it in slow mo.
From every meeting we have.
Oh, wow. That's great. Doesn't it sound like a badminton
like a serve or like a lob?
When it hits.
Oh, right. When you're striking the shuttlecock.
How the hell? I had no idea that was what it was called. Shuttlecock? Are you kidding
Shuttlecock.
Oh, my God. This is the most we haven't even gotten to the isn't that terrible?
Yeah.
So we got penis in the Trump story. We got penis in the egging story.
All right. So what do we have for isn't that terrible?
All right. Let's start with an article. Let's see. Complex lays it out. The Complex article, Wilson. So I can also just tell it to you. But basically, it's a story as old as time. Teen gets USB cable stuck in his penis and botched measuring attempt. A UK-based teenager had to undergo emergency penis surgery after he somehow managed to insert a whole USB cable into his urethra. Now, this is a serious story. This was actually published in Science Direct, and they have a very detailed article about it. It took place in London. When the teen was transferred to the University College Hospital in London, the end of the USB cable was protruding from the end of his penis. He later requested for further examination without his mother present, at which point he admitted that he inserted the cable to, quote, measure the length of his penis, triggered by sexual curiosity. I kind of admire that he didn't from the get-go ask to be questioned without his mother present.
What, like he thought he was going to get away with it?
Well, I mean, if I'm him, I'm like right away asking to be emancipated from my mother at the hospital.
Yeah.
Like, do you want her there for any part of this? When you have a protruding USB?
Yeah. No, I don't.
Okay. I mean, I don't know. I should not. You're the dude. So let's see, though, if there's an actual, I don't know if this is too awful, but there.
Well, I saw the X-ray.
That's an actual X-ray. How can we describe this to people? The problem was that it was not, apparently the problem, due to the positioning, which was confirmed by X-ray, surgeons had to make an incision between his genitals and anus to pull the cable out. Quote, the knotted cable was revealed in the proximal aspect of the penile urethra and cut from the remainder of the cord, the case report reads. The urethra was closed with interrupted sutures and a urethral catheter was inserted. His recovery was uneventful and he was discharged the following day with simple analgesia, oral antibiotics, and the urethra and suprapubic catheters in situ. 2 weeks after the surgery, the teen had a follow-up appointment to assess how his healing had been going. No evidence of urine leak or urethral stricture was observed, apart from a slight caliber changing at the distal, bulbar, and proximal penile urethra. The catheter was removed successfully, and ongoing follow-up is required to monitor for any long-term damage. How lucky is this guy?
He's lucky.
I mean, unlucky in that he decided it would be a good idea to put a USB in his urethra. But lucky, I'm going to say, given the outcome. It sounds like he has a still functioning penis.
Yeah, definitely. That's fortunate.
Do you know, by the way, that there's a term for this when you put something
up your urethra? Up
in your urethra, yeah.
No, what's the term for that?
I don't know why it's called this. Sounding. And there are even sounding kits available to purchase online, which often consists of metal rods of various sizes.
It's like when you're on a boat and you're sounding the depth.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
What does that mean? What do you do when you do that?
17 feet, sir, captain.
Is there any sound involved? No.
Or lengths or whatever. No, you're shoving a thing to the bottom of the ocean floor to sound the depths, right?
Well, yeah, I guess so. I don't know what's about sounding in either context, but
look, it's just really just never put anything in your
I mean, yeah, at the risk of kink shaming, I would say let's not do that, guys. But sounding is a thing, and if we could just click on, you know, we do like to give shout outs to shouts out to good puns. So this the journalist who wrote about this case refer to another case that had some very good coverage, so to speak, at the New York Post. We could just click on that. So this is another example of sounding, and the headline reads, Jack and the Bean Block. Man gets 6 kidney beans stuck in penis while trying to, quote unquote, express himself. He was struggling to pee, P-E-A. A Randy, Michigan man redefined C-block after he got 6 kidney beans lodged in his urethra during a bizarre attempt at sexual gratification. The unnamed 30-year-old patient had repeatedly wanted to express the beans during ejaculation. According...
I was trying to figure out what the end game was there, but yeah. That's pretty funny.
Of course, that makes total sense. Express the beans during the ejaculation, according to the Wince-worthy report published in the Journal of Urology Case Reports. So the sexual eccentric shoved 6 kidney beans in his urethra and attempted to expel them via natural emission. However, his pea shooter jammed during the process, prompting him to try to remove them with tweezers. When that failed, he reported to the hospital where he informed doctors he was struggling to pee. And then we have an actual CT scan showing 3 of the beans in the distal penile urethra. The backed up bean stalker also admitted it wasn't his first time participating in this practice, although he never attempted to utilize this many beans. A subsequent CT scan confirmed that the poor soul harbored 6 beans in his urethra, which measured by which measured 15 millimeters by 7 millimeters each. 4 were located between the urethral entrance and the urine pouch, while another had straight all the way to the bladder. Oh my God. After initially failing to extract the urethral, infiltrators, medics managed to remove 1 legume by applying numbing cream to the area and then squeezing the penile passageway, the researchers reported. They eradicated the rest of the beans the following day via a complex process that involved holding the man's urinary entrance open and inserting a tube through which they passed surgical implements. They then plucked out the taco toppers. With a tweezer-like tool and placed them in a basket. During the highly invasive procedure, the Frijoles fetishist suffered minimal trauma to his urethra.
I love that alliteration. Way to go.
Great.
Are those the beans?
I think so.
That is... I don't know what we're looking at there. So that's
he should thank his lucky stars. In a similar instance of beans in the urethra, the legumes had swollen to the point that endoscopic retrieval was impossible. It's unclear why someone would ever treat their manhood like a rain stick. However, experts say the sexual proclivity stems from psychiatric illness, sexual assault, or even attempts to somewhat paradoxically relieve urinary obstruction per the study. Experts have also blamed sounding, a bizarre sexual proclivity defined by sticking foreign bodies in one's urethra. In October 2019, a man in Saudi Arabia made the world wince after revealing that he'd harbored tweezers in the urethra for 4 years. Oh my God. Unsurprisingly, scholarship on this subject is scarce due to its taboo nature, which is why we cover this on Useful Idiots. We are actually doing something to raise awareness, remove the stigma.
Yeah, that these guys have raised the bar, though. Like, I think if you want to get our attention the next time, it's got to be something like more intense.
I know,
intense,
not
like
that we're encouraging that at all.
Like a PS4 controller or...
Tweezers, what? Why?
Yeah, tweezers, it doesn't... I'm not really sure.
You're like, you get the beans, maybe?
I don't get the beans either. Like,
less gettable with tweezers.
Yeah, the tweezers part, because like, no matter how you do it, it's going to end up hurting in one direction, right?
Yeah. Why do, yeah.
That, you know, this is the kind of stuff where, like, you know, normally I'm all, if I see headlines, like, there's too much democracy and, like, you know, not everybody should be allowed to vote and everything like that. And I always usually get hot and bothered, like, that's ridiculous. You know, everyone should have a say in democracy. But, if you're shoving tweezers up your urethra, well, no, you should still
vote.
Are
you saying no right to vote, or are you saying you get paternalistic about it?
No, I'm just saying, like, it starts to make me wonder about, like, just the decision-making of people.
You don't know if you want them pulling a lever, but come on, I got to get a better, the bean sprouts of democracy. No, it doesn't work.
Beans.
That sounds so harmless compared to let's be real, guys.
It
this
sounds
is
little...
like best practices for sounding. Beans versus a tweezer or a USB. And if you're going to use a USB, make it not knotted. Not that I'm endorsing any of this. Another guy did that, remember? Did he swallow it? No, he didn't swallow it.
It feels like a German fairy tale, you know, like...
Jack and the Beanstalk.
Hans put 6 magic beans up his urethra, and then they, you know, and they
what did they sprout?
No, and they turned into a fairy princess who granted him three wishes.
I see, right.
You know what I'm saying?
When he extract, what was the verb that they used?
Express.
Express them.
Yeah. If you can express these, if you can, and she's got her little wand.
Right.
If you can express these six magic beans, you can get everything you want. Something like
would
that.
Would they come out as like refried?
Would they be sizzling? I'm not sure.
I mean, I'm not even talking about in the fairy tale. I'm just saying if, as a matter of bio, you know, anatomy.
This stuff makes me feel really boring.
Oh yeah, it's okay. I embrace the boring.
Yeah, all right.
I mean, yeah, I'm just thinking, would they, depending on how long they were in there, I guess they could be expressed as like, I mean,
why kidney beans? I guess why
like a
beans?
Nice, no, like a little nice, what are small, a black eyed pea would be a much better, more humane.
Even a navy bean might.
Even a navy bean. A chickpea, no. See, next
to the those would smush.
The kidney bean. Well, the kidney beans should be smushed also more than the chickpea. The chickpea is firmer.
No, see, they need to soak.
What I don't also get is like, why would you? It's just like a warning sign. It's called a kidney bean. Like, do you want it to end up in your kidneys? Because that could happen. You know what I mean? It's like calling it a bladder bean.
I think that person just needs less spare time. That's just my way of looking
cut
at it.
To him being like, I don't know, like working in a sweatshop or something. That would be very unfortunate. Imagine that. Imagine how committed you have to be if you were working.
Yeah. I better get home quick. I've only got 11 minutes to get them up there.
Oh my God.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was certainly weird. So
terrible.
Sorry. That was certainly terrible. So those are the four food groups this week. Look, semi-literally. And actually we had eggs. We had beans. We had all kinds of stuff going on.
We had eggs. We had beans. We had mushrooms. We had penises.
Well, those aren't really food, hopefully.
Oh, well, I mean... Yeah. Problematic, Matt.
Yeah. Anyway, those are the four food groups. So we are now going to interview an extremely interesting person whose name is Josiah Zahner. And I did a story on him last week describing him as America's most censored person. We've done a bunch of shows on Useful Idiots about people who've had things removed from the internet, from
their penises. Sorry.
People like Michael Moore.
Yes, yeah. Ali Abu Nima, Michael Moore. They've had things removed from the internet. It's true. Yeah.
Right.
Max Blumenthal.
Right. There have been a bunch of people from Jordan Sheridan.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. So it's a theme. Like we're interested in this topic of internet censorship. This story is like the mother of all internet censorship stories, and it goes in all directions. This is a scientist who runs a company called Odin, who is famous as what they call a biohacker. And he'll explain what that is. But his experience is really, really interesting because it delves into all sorts of issues that are, probably going to be very relevant in the near future. Like, you know, given that almost all commerce is now done through the internet, what happens if you have an activity that the government says is legal, but the tech companies don't like, you know, what happens then? Can they shut you down for that? Like, you know, so this is a person who's been kind of bounced from almost every corner of the internet for a variety of reasons. Super interesting guy, very smart, free thinker, should be a fascinating conversation.
Yeah, we should you not.
Welcome, Josiah Zahner, to Useful Idiots. Thanks so much for coming on. Appreciate it.
I think it's a really good way to describe me, you know. I think that's the way I describe myself, is kind of like a useful idiot.
Well, that's good. Then you'll fit right in with the show then. So you and I spoke last week. I did a story, described you as sort of the most censored person in America. Now you have a company called Odin. First of all, what does Odin sell? Let's get that out of the way. Like, what is a genetic engineering, home genetic engineering kit? What's CRISPR? For people who don't know, like,
I realized that a lot of these science and medical technologies that we have, like, the only reason people can't or aren't using them is because there's this knowledge gap, right? And especially in science, the knowledge gap is like things are behind paywalls. That knowledge gap is something that can be fixed. All we have to do is educate people. It's like computers. I think about this a lot, right? We like use our computers or we like use our phones. And like most people have not taken a class to like how to use a smartphone or like how to use a computer. They're intuitive. You learned about it. You grew up with it and all this different stuff, right? It's just like cultural knowledge that we all have now, just because these pieces of equipment are so ubiquitous in our environments. And you look at something like genetic engineering, which can like cure diseases, right? Gene therapies can cure and treat diseases. We can engineer animals and plants, you know, to make fuels and food and crazy stuff. The applications are crazy limitless. We just need people working on it. And the only reason people aren't working on it is because there's that knowledge gap. If you want to figure out how to do this stuff, first you got to get access to an academic paper, which is behind a paywall. Then you have to be able to understand it and read it and synthesize it and then get the equipment and all this stuff. And my idea was just like, what if we just cut out all the middle, you know, and just say, here's a kit. We're going to synthesize all the knowledge for you. We're going to provide all the materials and you're going to learn to do genetic engineering in, you know, a couple of days. Are you going to be a genius and know everything about genetic engineering? No, but you're going to have that hands-on experience. And if we can build it up enough, make it ubiquitous enough, then like the idea that anybody can do genetic engineering, anybody can make a medicine or gene therapy or something like that, I think is real, or at least more people can do it. Like, I think that's real. And I think it can really change a lot. So we sell genetic engineering kits to teach people how to do this stuff. Yeah.
So it's educational, I mean, right? Like the experience that you're selling, people are learning about genetic engineering is sort of the idea, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the whole thing that we're going for. Like, we don't sell any drugs or medicines or anything like that. But I think the lack of knowledge around it makes people think we do, and kind of like pushes people in this direction of like, oh gosh, you know, genetic engineering or like, you know, all this stuff, like, oh, they're trying to make new drugs or medicines or sell things to people or scam people. Or yeah, I think there's a lot of lack of knowledge in that area in general, or misinformation.
Well, how much does the profit motive also in general kind of like distort what's focused on or what's prioritized?
I mean, in my company or in
oh no, sorry, I meant in general in science.
So much, right? You have to understand that like the drug market is so messed up. It's so messed up because these companies are only trying to make drugs that make money. And so, well, it's because the regulatory process is somewhat, right? So the FDA makes it really difficult to make drugs, because they're trying to protect people, which we can say, okay, they really are trying to protect people to some extent. So they make the process really difficult. Because the process is so difficult, it costs a lot of money. Because it costs a lot of money, nobody's going to do it unless they can make a lot of money, right?
It's like a catch-22, yeah.
Yeah, so it sets up this system that's purely profit motivated, right? Because they want to be able to keep doing it, right? Because it's not so government funded, it's not, you know, something that is a big focus. And so it's this really messed up system where, like, you know, about 60 drugs are approved every year by the FDA, give or take, sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little less. The majority of those drugs are derivatives or drugs for diseases that we already have treatments for. So the amount of new drugs for new diseases that come out are just like a handful each year, right? So you're thinking like how many diseases there are in the world, you know, there's a lot. According to the HWO, you know, there's tens of thousands, right? And we have three, maybe, you know, five new drugs coming out a year. It's like at this pace, it's going to take an eternity before we find treatments for anything.
Right. It's like half of the new drugs that are coming out are like, I don't know, like an ACE inhibitor that has like an, you know, an acid in it or something like that, right? It's
totally.
Like a cross of two things that, you know, they're already selling it, but they've decided to market a new product that they can make more money on by selling it, you know, bilking insurance companies or something like that.
Totally. I read because after like 20 years, I think it's 20 years, the drug becomes generic. And so what companies will do is they'll make a slightly different drug that is like a slightly different chemical structure, or is like more, no joke, it'll just be like slightly more purified. So it'd be slightly more pure. They'll go to the FDA, they'll get approval for that, and then they'll start marketing and selling that. And then, you know, this has happened a lot in the like antacid, like acid reflux market, where there's like 50 drugs, you know, that all basically do the same thing, that are all like billion-dollar drug. It's like, do we really need another antacid or like acid reflux drug? No, but they know they can make money off of it. They know that like it'll get approved, and so it's just
There are all these big drug companies. Some of them are doing crazy things, like Purdue Pharma, or you know, they're making oxycodone, stuff that has a lot huge impact on the world. But for some reason, there's immediately all this attention on you. What happened first? You got delisted by some internet platforms. There was, I think,
First thing that probably happened to me was the FDA contacted me. We started selling a genetically modified yeast for brewing and baking. It was genetically modified so it fluoresced. It like glowed green. It used a jellyfish protein, you know, to make it glow green. And
so you could have like glowing green food?
Yeah, that it's made with yeast. So you can have glowing green beer a little bit. I mean, it's in the yeast, so you have to like keep the yeast in the beer. But yeah, it was basically what you can do. And
for St. Patty's Day.
Yeah, it'd be perfect. And the FDA contacted us and was like, you can't do this. You can't sell this. You can't market it that way. And we're like, what? Like, you know, we did all the basic research that is normally required to make something like this, what they consider, they call it GRAS, generally recognized as safe. You look up and see whether it's a toxin or allergen, or whether the chemical structure of it matches any known toxin or allergen or things like that. It needs to go through animal testing, which, you know, this jellyfish protein has been through a ton of animal testing already. And so we were like, this is ridiculous. Basically, what you're asking us is to like repeat every experiment that's ever been done, pay a bunch of money, come to you, ask you for approval, just so we can have teach people how to genetically modify a yeast to make it glow. Like, that just sounds crazy.
Before we move on more to your story, just wanted to ask somebody else about the profit motive, because you and Matt were both talking about this kind of American tradition of DIY and unlimited imagination. And then on the other end of the spectrum, it seems like there's also the alternative of more kind of like government funded, right? So you have, you know, like Cuba does all these things with medicine. They discovered like the meningitis vaccine. Yeah. So what's the solution? I mean, what should people be pushing for?
It's complicated, right? Because like, here's the thing is that like the FDA, it generally does good work, right? They make it so that drugs are generally safe. So you make a drug that can reach the most people, hurt the least amount of people, and drug companies can make money off of it so they can try to make more drugs, right? That's just like a basic ecosystem, and it generally works. The problem is it doesn't leave any room for innovation or trying new things. I know so many people, I get emails every day, messages 20 times a day. You know, I just can't even read them anymore because they're so heavy. I just, you know, right before this, I got an email from somebody. I mean, I could even, let me just pull it up really quick.
If it's from someone who put beans in his penis. We just did a story on that.
No, my mother was diagnosed last December with endometrial carcinoma, which is very rare and very aggressive type of cancer, blah, 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 blah. I am running out of official treatment options in time. Last November, I read a news article about science treating cancers in mice using genetic engineering techniques. I'm writing to ask you to help me in answering questions and being able to do this. They want to replicate this experiment to save their mother's life, right? You can't. It's illegal, even if somebody is literally about to die, for me or a medical doctor or anyone else to try some cutting edge experiment on them. Even if it's been tried in animals or anything, right? It's illegal, you'll go to jail. And so there's no room in the regulatory environment for that, for this like last ditch effort or experimentation that we need, right? Because individuals aren't getting the treatments that they need. Mass population is, but there's a ton of people slipping through the cracks because drug companies aren't making drugs for them.
Especially for sort of small idiosyncratic rare diseases, right? Because there's no margin in that for the drug companies.
You want to hear a super fucked up story. So in the European Union in like 2016, there was a gene therapy, the first gene therapy ever approved, called Glybera, that was approved to treat this disease, lipoprotein lipase deficiency. Basically what it is a buildup of fat in your blood, and that causes all sorts of problems you can imagine, right? Because you don't have the enzymes and stuff to break down the fat. This gene therapy is basically just giving you that enzyme so you can break down the fat. The pharmaceutical company, it got approved, and then they tried to sell it for $1 million. And I think like one person paid for it and nobody else could really afford it. And so they took it off the market because they're just like, it's too expensive to try to keep manufacturing this drug and nobody's willing to pay for it. So like, we're not even going to sell it. So we literally have a cure. It went through clinical trials. We literally have a cure for a disease that exists that is not being provided to people because drug companies think they can't get the price they deserve for it. Like, how fucked up is that? That's insane. So messed up. Right? Because somebody could be manufacturing, some government could be manufacturing this and providing it to the people that need it. You know, yes, it's a rare disease and there's not a lot of people who have it, but like, that's it. It's pure profit, pure money, right? We have the cure. And it's like one of those conspiracy theories that people talk about, like the government's hiding a treatment for cancer or something. I don't think anybody's hiding it. I think that they can't make the profit that they want to make off of it. And so right. There's probably a lot of these things out there like that are just like, you know, yeah, we can help these people, but like, who's going to make money off of it?
Okay. Well, that's a good segue into this other issue that you had that involved another sort of biohack that you did last summer. It's obviously a different scenario, but can you tell us what happened? You read a paper in May after the pandemic starts. You read a paper in May of last year that's about some scientists who I guess they tested a DNA vaccine on macaques, and you basically thought, why isn't anybody working on this, and decided to try it on yourself, right? Is that an accurate reflection of what happened?
Yeah, you know, that's generally the way I pick like experiments to do or things like that is like, if it keeps me up for a couple nights and I can't sleep and I just constantly think about it. And I read this scientific paper and they created a DNA vaccine. It's really similar to the mRNA vaccines that everybody are getting. It encodes the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, right? And they injected it in macaque monkeys. And they even challenged them with COVID. And they found that the monkeys that had the vaccine had, you know, were protected. And it was pretty crazy because I was like, wow, you know, that's like amazing data, right? Like, why isn't everybody jumping on this? Why isn't everybody trying to, like, there's no other, I think, any other study that was done in monkeys for any other vaccine, at least that was public and published and all this stuff. least not that I know of. There might be some out there, so don't judge me if there is and I missed it. But this was so prominent and out there, and I was just like, why is nobody working on this? Like, this is crazy. I expected like drug companies just to pop up and come out and get like $1 billion investment from the US government for something like this, especially because DNA is way more stable than mRNA, right? The problem is with RNA and DNA is RNA has like a specific chemical structure that makes it so that it actually breaks down just in water. So if you leave it in water long enough, it's going to break down fairly fast. That's why you have to freeze it at like really cold temperatures so that this breakdown process doesn't happen very fast. Whereas DNA, you know, DNA, you can leave at any temperature, you can spit in it and, you know, throw it against the wall and whatever. And it's usually pretty robust, you know, like our DNA in our bodies, and we find DNA of organisms, you know, from long ago, like DNA is pretty strong. It's got a half-life of like 50,000 years. I was wondering like, why aren't people doing this? DNA is also much easier to produce, right? We don't have the technology or the easy way to produce mRNA like we do DNA. So it's strange.
Why is that? Forgive me for not knowing.
Because organisms will replicate DNA really easy. So I can trick like, say, a bacteria into making me a ton of DNA. Whereas mRNA, you have to, it's really hard to purify, to get specific parts of it, and to just make the whole thing. Whereas DNA, I can take my DNA vaccine, I could put it in some bacteria, some lab bacteria, and I could put little instructions in a piece of DNA that say, I want you to make 1 million copies of this for me, right? So you trick the bacteria, you basically hack and hijack the bacteria's, you know, normal cellular function to make you a bunch of DNA. And so you can just make untold amounts of it super easy, super inexpensively, right? So like when we decided to manufacture this DNA vaccine, I think it costs like $2,500 to synthesize. So they, you know, chemically synthesize and make the specific DNA we want, but then to actually copy it and manufacture it and produce enough for, you know, multiple doses, it was like $700 or, you know, $1,000. It was ridiculously inexpensive. And we didn't even do it at a scale that's like really big. So that price would drop down drastically. And yeah, it was just crazy why nobody was doing it. And I still haven't figured out, you know, what happened with that. And, you know, me and three other people, I wanted to make it a little bigger than just myself. And I wanted to show people that like what was possible. So I live streamed the whole thing and taught people every step. Like, how do you code DNA? This is how you can code and order the DNA for the spike protein vaccine. Like, I went through everything step by step by step, what, you know, requirements you need when you order it, what things you should look out for, you know, what quality control you should pay attention to, and all these things. And then we went on and we tested it. We tested it to make sure it worked in human cells, you know, so that it made
the protein. in vitro.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we had human cells that we grew in petri dishes, and we put the vaccine in and we saw that they made the protein. And then we went ahead and we said, all right, you know, let's like test this out on ourselves, you know, and let's see what happens. So we did the exact same dose that they did in the paper. The same experiment, basically. We just wanted to redo the exact same experiment and see if it would work in humans. And so we did dose 2 weeks apart, similar to what is done nowadays. I think they do 3 weeks apart or something like that. They saw that works slightly better. And we all saw an antibody response, which is interesting because like most people who get the vaccines nowadays, they're not tested for an antibody response, right? You just get the vaccine and you hope it works. Even though every human body is different, and some people will get an antibody response and some people won't. Some people will be stronger and some people will be less strong. But we didn't just test for an antibody response. We also tested to see if our antibodies would neutralize the virus. So there's like an assay you can do that uses the viral protein and sees and checks if it binds to the human ACE2 receptor. You can do this in like, you know, a plate and measure all these things that happen. And we showed that we had, before we did the second injection, we didn't have any viral neutralizing antibodies. And after, our viral neutralizing antibodies just started to go up.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it was like, wow, we have data that shows that like this thing, you know, had an immune response. I hate to say that it worked, because like human biology is complicated and like each person is different. But like we had an antibody response and a viral neutralizing antibody response. That's what the data says. You can't deny that stuff, right?
It's at least encouraging, right?
Well, I mean, it basically means that generally it should be protected, right? If you were to say, how does that translate to the real world? If somebody who's making a vaccine said like you had a viral neutralizing antibody response, you'd say, okay, that should protect you from the virus. So it should be no different than if, say, I went and got Moderna's or Pfizer's or anybody else, except the fact that like I'm tested. Most people aren't. Most people don't know if the vaccine, like how well it worked on them, right? And I'm the one who doesn't have a vaccine card. I'm the one who like, you know, can't prove that I've been vaccinated. And that's kind of crazy.
So this was last summer that you did this, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. We started slightly after the paper came out and we did step by step. So it took us a little longer. We could have just injected it, you know, in June and been done with the experiment, but we wanted to show people like the step-by-step process of how you would create and test a vaccine, like real biomedicine. So we followed the paper and did the experiments they did. And so I think we finished sometime around September, August or September of 2020. So way before, you know, clinical trials had started recruiting by then, but way before it was able to be received by the general population.
Can you send this to countries that can't afford it?
Well, gosh, I was contacted by so many people. And that's the crazy thing where it was just like, but like, what do I do? Right? Like, I'm just a person. I'm not like wealthy or anything like that. I can't manufacture a ton of this and send it off to a country and be like, and like, who do I contact? You know, like, hey, I'm some random biohacker PhD guy. You know, most people don't even care about the data or the science or anything like that. They care where it came from. Did it come from Fauci? Did it come from the CDC? Or did it come from, you know, somebody else? But I was contacted by a ton of people. And, you know, even recently, the crazy thing is like just September, this month, India came out and said that they're using a vaccine that's almost identical to the one we used.
A DNA right? vaccine. Right?
DNA vaccine. And that's just like, what the fuck? You know, like, what took so long?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com.
So that was interesting. Well, I could tell you're a
but
little
it wasn't
bit conf-
about him. It's not about him. It's just mm-hmm. the issue in general. Like, I don't like, he is a pro-vax guy. He's not an anti-vax guy. I just think that these issues that we're raising in general, I do feel conflicted about them, which, and I don't have an answer. I don't know what the answer is. I mean, I feel like for me, the easy out is that I don't trust what YouTube does. I don't trust these companies. But I don't know, and maybe this is like 1984-ish of me, and I know you've made the point, Matt, that once we take away certain rights or we impose certain things for like emergency situations, it's hard to get them, it's hard to remove them later on. I guess this is just, you know, there are lots of trade-offs, so maybe it's not that deep. Maybe there's lots of stuff that I think is very bad that's on YouTube, and the answer is not to ban it. But I am disturbed, I'm not going to lie, and this will get me, a lot of people will turn on me, but like, I am disturbed by some of the information out there about the vaccine, but whatever, free speech, that's the point, right? You defend it when it's disturbing.
Well, so I think I've had consistent with the company's response over COVID is that they, you know, they kind of approach problems that at best should be dealt with surgically. They kind of use a bazooka at them. So anything that to them sounds like, you know, it's anything other than take the mRNA vaccine, it just falls under the rubric of like a prohibited category of speech.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like in the case of Josiah, and I know that there are people out there that there are scientists who say things like what he did wasn't even that interesting, or, you know, like it's it's not a big deal. You know, it doesn't prove anything. It's not science, whatever. But, you know, look, it's a true thing that happened. They actually did do it. I feel the same way about this that I feel about like true news stories. Like you get in trouble when you cover up, when you remove something that's true, right, because it has the wrong message, that you, ultimately that's always ends up being self-defeating.
Yeah.
You know, like, right, maybe
you create martyrs.
Yeah. And also someday it might actually be helpful for somebody who's working on something else to say, oh, you know, this person did this, and
yeah,
maybe that becomes part of their thinking about something else. Like the more stuff that's out there to know, the better. That was the whole idea behind the internet to begin with.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying this to cover my ass or cover our asses, because we just had this guy on. I legit think there's a big difference between what he's doing and the people who are saying, don't take the vaccine. Vaccine will kill you. Vaccine will make you, you know, will fuck you up. Take ivermectin instead. Like, I don't think that he, for me, what he did doesn't fall under that category of things that make me go, not sure what to do about this.
Mm-hmm.
Which isn't, but that there's still a problem, I think, about how we respond to it. I don't know the answer, but it doesn't apply to him. If that makes sense, what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think his case is like easy either. Like, if I were the head of the FDA, like, how sure am I that I want people out there making their own vaccines? Like, I would probably think twice about that. Like, I mean, I can definitely see the argument. Although I ultimately I come down on the idea that, you know, letting people do crazy experiments, you know, it's a net plus in our history, you know. Yeah. I think that's been true, right? So
yes, I guess I'd see that slightly different from discouraging people from taking vaccines. That it is weird, there's like a real divide on the left now.
In what way?
Well, there's certain people I think who were used to being fellow travelers ideologically, and there are some people on the left who I think are more critical of the vaccine. That's causing like a division where one doesn't usually exist. I mean, this happens a lot with politics, but I think it's, what's interesting to me is with the vaccine apartheid stuff, because most leftists I know, it makes sense that we stand in solidarity with all the people in India or other countries who are demanding that the government, you know, make these drugs accessible. But there's some leftists who are very critical of the vaccine, don't really believe in it. They don't think that there should be mandates, but it's not just that there shouldn't be mandates. They just think that people shouldn't, they think that there's the trade-off isn't worth it, which puts them at odds with these people who they would otherwise be agreeing with, these activists in other countries.
Yeah, I mean, it's, there's a lot of tough issues here. Like the mandate's not an easy issue. The censorship stuff. I'm very anti-censorship in general. But there's a couple instances where you can make the argument that, you know, we're not talking about a speech issue. We're talking about a crime issue, right? Like if you tell somebody to, you know, they're going to be cured of COVID if they swallow rat poison. You know what I'm saying? Like, there are some things where it starts to get into not being a First Amendment issue and becoming something else. But you know, there's a lot of difficult issues here. Like the route that they've chosen, which is let's prohibit any speech that doesn't say that this one vaccine is the right one and is infallible, is inherently to me problematic, because it ends up raising more questions than it answers. Just to go back to the thing with like ivermectin, like if I had to guess, I would guess that ivermectin probably is not a prophylactic or you know, maybe at best it might help lessen symptoms or something I don't know, right? But the thing is, when you step in and you start preventing people from saying it's a human medicine that with a track record, it's just a horse dewormer, the first thing that people do is they go and look online and they see that that's not true. You know what I'm saying? So
it creates a much bigger credibility gap.
Right. And crisis. that's And that's what I think there's a lot of that going on, where it's like, for safety's sake, let's eliminate, you know, these 10 things that people are saying that aren't exactly on message, and pretend that they're either not true or they don't exist or whatever it is. And then people find them, and then that raises questions in their mind, and that just contributes to the problems, you know. Not a fan of any of that. And, you know, and this guy's, you know, in Josiah's case is interesting, because, again, you know, what happens in the future where somebody develops a product that they do all the work to get to market, and they pass muster with the FDA or whoever it is, whatever the regulatory body is, but suddenly YouTube or Google or Amazon or PayPal or MasterCard or whoever it is decides they don't like this product. So now they're going to impose their own idea of regulation on it. Like, that's a new thing. We just sort of haven't had that issue in America, where it's, you know, in addition to the official regulatory structure, where there's now this secondary thing that you have to grapple with that, you know, there's no process for, you know, that's weird too.
Yeah, it's a shit show. And there's so much cancellation also makes me afraid of even saying anything. There's like cancel culture, which I know doesn't exist, but whatever. There are people who, there's certain things you're allowed to say. You know, we've talked about this before. You're either a neoliberal shill or a grifter. There's right. That, you know. And even now with this, like, I'm afraid of YouTube, you know, taking down one of our videos, or with this video. Like, that's the irony, is I've done episodes that are very pro, I don't want to say pro-vaccine. I guess they are pro-vaccine, but like, Big Pharma's awful. It's also a weird position too, where it's like, I acknowledge that these, like, they're doing it for the wrong reasons, but these things are, I think, save people's lives. I'm worried that YouTube will just see the words, or, you know, because they go through the videos and see what words are there.
That's not a position that anybody who's in media should ever have to be in, right? Like, I did an interview with pretty reputable legacy media company. The interview was about something else, but ivermectin came up, and they were, you know, so off camera, like, they were nervous about, like, how to ask the questions, you know, like, how do we ask the questions so that we don't get into a place where this video ends up getting, you know,
demonetized or whatever,
right?
Moved down in the search. Algorithm.
And we weren't talking about anything that had anything to do with, you know, not taking the vaccine or anything like that. It was strictly like, you know, it was about court cases where people had tried to get permission to take the drug or whatever it was, right? It was something silly like that. All these thoughts that are in our heads now about things we maybe can't say, are we sure we can say them?
Like, yeah.
That's totally new. We didn't deal with that even when we started the show a couple of years ago. I mean, there was maybe thought about some of the Russia stuff getting us in trouble, like on Twitter, but, like, you know, in terms of getting yanked off the internet, that's new. But anyway, interesting talk with Josiah, and we will see you again on Monday.
Yeah. And we'll have some updates about infrastructure and debt ceiling. All that stuff is still going on.
And your co-host appearance on Real Time with Bill Maher. So.
Oh, yeah, guys, look out for it. It'll be tonight. Matt Taibbi will be on Bill Maher. Huge news. He got that Katie Halper bump.
That's
finally
right.
Yep. Moved him. They decided to invite Matt Taibbi on for the first time ever. He's never done Real Time with Bill Maher except three times before. How many times have you done it?
Oh, I was actually more than that. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I was like a regular contributor to them once for the campaign. Like, I did videos for them.
But you weren't, right. But in studio, you've done it what? Like,
probably five times, maybe.
There you go.
Five, six, something like that. So, yeah. Scary show. It's like hard to do.
But, yeah. You never know. Matt looks, it looks so effortless when Matt's on. I'm not being
I don't know. We'll see.
You
anyway,
tips for staying calm, cool, and collected. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll see how it works out, but we'll see you on Monday.
Yes. See you Monday, Monday morning.
All right, take care.
Bye, everyone. Hello, thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday Morning Show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.